Composer Mark Abel didn't take a traditional route when it came to composing classical music. He served as a specialist in foreign news at the San Francisco Chronicle. He did a little rock, he did a little jazz, and then he found his way back to classical music. He grew up listening to it with his dad, who was also a foreign correspondent. It's that music that influenced Mark's first full-fledged chamber music recording. It's called The Cave of Wondrous Voice. And you're going to hear more about it on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Macher. I'm talking with composer Mark Abel about his newest recording, The Cave of Wondrous Voice. Thank you for joining me, Mark.
You bet, Julie. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about you yourself. I know you're a California-based composer, and you've explored everything from rock to jazz and classical. And I also heard that you did a stint at a newspaper in San Francisco, and that was one of the things that helped you dive a little deeper into the classical repertoire. Is that so?
I don't know the extent to which my newspaper work had any cross influence with music or vice versa. It was something that I was doing to make a living. It was very absorbing work and very responsible work. So it definitely occupied almost all of my brain during the working hours. And then I would come home and work as much as energy I had left on trying to move forward with my classical endeavor, which is a long gestating thing. So I'm not sure that they influenced each other, but I was a specialist in foreign news at the San Francisco Chronicle, and I oversaw a network of foreign correspondents for almost 10 years and wound up being the foreign editor of the paper. But I have quite an interest in other countries and cultures. And I guess you could say the newspaper work helped feed that further, and maybe it cross-pollinated into the music a little bit, because despite kind of sublimated rock and jazz influences in my music, the composers who have been most influential on me have been from the European tradition.
Well, that's really interesting, because it sounds like you actually were diving into a completely different career and somehow was composing part of this all along, or did you kind of find your way into composing through this process?
No, I had about a dozen year career as a rock musician in New York City, starting around 1970 or so. Didn't have too much success with it, but did make a number of records and produce things for other people. But by the time I hit 30 or so, rock had ceased to thrill me. And throughout my life, I've always had to listen to something that's beyond what I'm capable of at the time. And I had been into classical as a young kid, leaning on my father's 19th century favorite composers. And towards the end of my rock adventure, I realized that neither rock nor jazz was doing it for me that much anymore. So I began an investigation of a lot of the composers that I didn't hear when I was a little kid. And that took a long time. And as I mentioned, I was at the same time doing some very demanding work during the day, which spread the whole thing out a bit. But there was no deadline. I could do it for as long as I wanted to. And I definitely did find the people that I was looking for who I didn't know, and then tried to incorporate it into my own compositional endeavor, which I didn't really know whether it was going to get off the ground or cohere enough to be deemed credible by the classical world. It took a long time, but eventually I was able to kind of shoehorn the various influences that I have into something that I think holds together pretty well.
You mentioned your dad loved classical music and he loved chamber music. So I'm wondering how his love of chamber music perhaps inspired your first full-fledged chamber recording.
Well, I would say that, he loved chamber music more than orchestral music. He wasn't much of an opera fan. So I heard a lot of Brahms and Beethoven and Mozart and Dvorak and a few other people when I was growing up. So it's kind of ironic that it took me decades and decades to get around to trying to crack the nut of writing for chamber music, because in fact, I've been hearing that idiom since I was very young. But as I just said, it was very frustrating and very difficult for me to turn it into something that works, because of the rock background. I had a whole history of writing for voice before I started writing classical. And I found that I was able to hang on to at least my ability to work with words and music and transmute it into something else. But my first attempts at writing chamber just didn't work. They were stiff, and they didn't have the flow and organicity that chamber needs. And I really didn't know how to fix it, because I felt that the organicity is in my vocal music. You can hear it in the vocal music, but somehow I couldn't transfer it over to chamber. And then 3 years ago, magically, I have no idea how this happened, whatever block was in my brain up to that point dissolved. And it probably fitting that the first piece that I produced was a clarinet trio, since Brahms's clarinet trio is such a cornerstone of that repertoire.
I'm going to ask you more about that, but first I have one more question about your dad. He was actually kind of friends with some top level musicians like Leonard Bernstein and Nathan Milstein.
Yeah.
Are those people that you encountered growing up?
I met Bernstein once and I met Milstein once. My dad was a pretty well-known foreign correspondent. So his encounters with people like that, I usually wasn't tagging along for them, but his reverence for people on that level, it just made an impression on me. I'm not sure what the impression was. I mean, my dad was, I mean, he took me to a concert in Vienna of Milstein playing nothing but unaccompanied Bach at age 7 or 8, which is really kind of too young, I think, to take in unaccompanied Bach. But he wanted to hear Milstein, and I'm glad that he brought me. I just wasn't ready for it.
The title of your new chamber music recording is called The Cave of Wondrous Voice. Why is that the title?
It's actually a line from one of the Marina Tsvetaeva poems in the cycle of her work that I set. And I just loved the phrase so much that it just flew out at me and told me that it should be the title of the record.
I do want to talk about this beautiful suite of songs, and you just referred to the four poems upon which they are based. And you're also working with an incredible soprano once again. You and Hila Plitman have worked together several times. How was having a soloist of her caliber interested in you and your work? How has that really made a difference for you?
It's made a tremendous difference. I mean, I'm sort of coming out of left field in the classical world in a lot of ways. I didn't go to conservatory. I'm completely self-taught. And what toehold I was able to get early on, I wasn't really in a position, I felt, to approach somebody of Hila Plitman's stature for a while. But she liked the first piece that I offered to her, which is a piece called The Palm Trees Are Restless. And I'd worked with some really darn good singers up to that point, but she's kind of on a transcendental level in terms of technique and emotion. And it's just been my great fortune that she still likes what I do. And we have some projects coming up. So she has, to use the basketball phrase, she's really helped me up my game, because she can just do things that other people can't do. And I'm just, you know, eternally grateful for her interest, I have to say.
This is the first setting of the poetry of Marina Tsvetaeva in English translations. Why is that?
Good question. And I don't have much of an answer other than her stuff is real difficult to translate. But she is widely accepted as one of the most important figures in Russian poetry. But she still has a long way to go in the United States for people to become familiar with her idiom. I know about her because I first heard her name in conjunction with the Shostakovich recording of a 6-song setting of her stuff. That was the first time I was exposed to it. And then I investigated, and her life story is a pretty extraordinary one. It's a complicated, tumultuous life. She happens to be a great poet, as well as being a very signal example of the havoc that Joseph Stalin, you know, wreaked on his own people. She committed suicide in 1941 because literally she couldn't find food for her and her son, who had been placed in this internal exile. Her husband was executed. Her sister and a daughter went to the gulag. It's a horrendous story. And her poetry is so visceral and so original that it just gives you a very vivid sense of what was going on between the wars in Europe. She's just a very compelling figure.
Let's talk about each of these four songs, the first of which is the Sibyl. Tell me about this piece. What does it mean?
Well, among Tsvetaeva's many literary interests was ancient mythologies, and she latched on to the legend of oracles whose actual form came from the stump of a tree. And the very idea of a creature connected to the cosmos or to God can be placed in a form like that is kind of stunning enough by itself.
But God has come. God has come.
But when you follow what goes on in the poem, it ends with her service on earth being done, and she disappears into a whirlwind.
A whoosh of stars, Sibyl, as she quits this earth.
Let's just go through each of the other three songs. The next is Two Trees Desire to Come Together, which seems to flow beautifully out of the Sibyl then, kind of a similar idea there.
This is one of Tsvetaeva's kind of romantic but also very ambiguous treatments of nature personifying characteristics that we see in humans. In relationships, one person tends to be not necessarily the dominant one, but the one that the other one would do just about anything to have things work out with. And she decided to depict this dynamic in the form of trees. It's a wistful, reflective kind of poem, and it just grabbed my attention for sure.
The smaller one, its arms outreaching, just like a woman, overreaches, its finest echoes.
Then we have O Sorrow Floods My Eyes, which she wrote shortly after the Nazi invasion of Czechoslovakia, which is where she spent some very difficult years after the war. Can you talk a little bit about that piece?
Yeah. Tsvetaeva and her husband lived in Prague or outside Prague for quite some time, starting in the 1920s. Even though they were living in extreme poverty and things were really difficult, Tsvetaeva really liked the Czech people. And when the Nazis and, fascism in other forms was beginning to break loose and make it obvious that the world was about to go off the precipice, she was moved probably pretty quickly to write this particular poem. And I think it's a very powerful piece.
Floods my eyes.
And the Heliplitman, of course, is kind of an ideal. This is right up her alley, this kind of piece.
God Bent Under is the final song in this cycle. And I have to say, the text here is incredibly beautiful and the imagery. Talk about this piece, please.
God Bent Under.
Yeah, the imagery is really beautiful. You don't think very often of God as a person, but that's how Svetaeva depicts him in this piece. And the idea of him kind of tinkering with his human creations is a great little concept, because obviously we humans could stand some tweaking in our outlook towards life. And so the idea of him bending over and trying to make some adjustments that would make for a better life for everybody is pretty irresistible.
God himself.
The other pieces on this recording are instrumental works, which is a little bit unusual for you because you're known for your choral works and you've written an opera. One of the pieces is called The Elastic Hours, and I know you also came up with the titles after you wrote the piece. So can you talk a little bit about how you came to call it Elastic Hours?
Well, I sensed by the time I was done with the piece, before I put the titles on it, that the kind of progression, the speeding up and slowing down of time, that was a steady pulse going through both of the movements. So I think that's where the idea of the elastic hours came from. If you read my liner notes, or anybody reads my liner notes, I think that both movements do suggest the attention span of somebody going through a day and holding on to a certain thought. And then losing it and drifting off to something else. And that's really how people's subconsciouses function, I think.
David Schifrin and Carol Rosenberger are featured on two pieces. The first piece is called Intuition's Dance. What makes this piece so special?
Well, it's lighter than some of the pieces that I've written. It has a kind of a whimsical character to it. And that's why I decided to lead the record off with it, because it's a little bit different than what you expect from me. And I think the two of them play wonderfully together on it. And it only gives you a partly of an idea of what's going to follow on the record. It's kind of a romp in some ways, but it also has some very introverted sections. All I can say is it's just a piece that I wrote that I thought turned out well enough to be recorded.
As I was listening to your clarinet trio, I couldn't help but think that Brahms is probably in the back of your mind as you wrote this. Is that true?
Brahms undoubtedly is in the back of my mind, because I was exposed to so much of his music when I was young. There's something about his combination of seriousness and tender feelings. He's pretty hard to top in that category. In general, I would say does not kind of advertise or make obvious its influences, but I think that Brahms's own clarinet trio is such a classic. It's one of the greatest pieces in the genre, and I've known it since I was a kid. So I thought it would be a great combination of instruments to try to write really my first successful chamber piece. Thank you. end of it, the last minute and a half of it or so. Is a romantic gesture. I think you could say in a way that that's a bit of an homage to Brahms. But the rest of it, I think, is pretty much Mark Abel music.
One other thing I'm curious about, Mark, is what have you learned about yourself in the past few months during this pandemic?
That's a good one, Julie. I know that the performing end of the classical world has been turned upside down and had tremendous damage done into it during the pandemic. I'm kind of exempt from it in a way, being a composer, but there's people who have, you know, lost tremendous amounts of money, and it's a sobering episode, really an unprecedented episode in this country. I hope that somehow the classical world can bring itself back together again, but it's been in a dicey situation even before COVID-19 came along. The society is so speeded up and so focused on minutiae and trivia, in my opinion, that classical music is really fighting for its life right now.
That's interesting, because I've had some conversations with family members and friends about how we almost feel like we're hitting a reset button right now, you know, to get us to think about, well, what is important? What are the priorities?
Yes, I think that people individually, I hope that they're experiencing the reset thing. As far as the machinery of the classical music world, we'll see what the reset turns out to be there. I don't think anybody knows, but it's a moment for everybody to kind of reflect on where this world has gotten to. We're in need of some deep and sober reflection, I think. I know I'm doing that.
The Cave of Wondrous Voice, an irresistible new recording from composer Mark Abel. If you're enjoying new classical tracks, the absolute best thing that you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it, help spread the word, and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher.